KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Saudi Arabia and the UAE promised to invest billions in the U.S. and Qatar is in talks to donate a luxury plane that could become Air Force One. Why President Trump is on his way to Riyadh on Morning Edition from NPR News. Trump's plans to put tariffs on generic drugs made abroad is putting independent pharmacies in a bind. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. They cannot pass on extra costs to consumers. Generic drug makers predict shortages. Also, why the race to lead Washington, D.C.'s Bar Association is drawing national attention, and how an American investor in Russia found himself in a notorious Russian prison. It is Monday, May 12th. Chef and TV personality Carla Hall is 61 today, but who's going to make her birthday cake? The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Russia launched dozens of drone attacks across Ukraine overnight, killing at least one person and injuring nearly two dozen more. The attacks effectively mark Russia's rejection of calls by Kyiv and its European allies for an immediate ceasefire ahead of possible peace talks later this week. From Moscow, NPR's Charles Maines has more.
According to Ukrainian officials, Russia launched more than 100 drones across multiple regions of Ukraine beginning late Sunday. Russia's defense ministry confirmed the attacks, but said its forces struck a range of military targets, including Ukrainian army air bases and arms depots. Ukraine, with backing from the U.S. and Europe, had been demanding Monday mark the start of a month-long ceasefire, threatening massive new sanctions should Russia refuse. Instead, Russian President Vladimir Putin called for direct talks with Ukraine in Istanbul, Turkey later this week in an apparent attempt to seize the diplomatic initiative. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has since agreed to the talks but challenged Putin to meet in person. Charles Maines, NPR News. Moscow.
House Republicans have released an initial proposal for parts of their budget, and it includes general ideas about Medicaid. NPR's Elena Moore says the GOP is looking to slash federal spending.
GOP members have to come up with $1.5 trillion in proposed savings or cuts to offset the cost of things like making Trump's 2017 tax cuts permanent. That's about a quarter of annual federal spending. And some conservative Republicans say one way of getting there is restructuring some programs like Medicaid. But moderate Republicans who face competitive reelection races next year are very much against massive changes to the program.
NPR's Elena Moore reporting. President Trump says he'll sign an executive order today that he claims will cut prescription drug prices between 30% and 80%. He hasn't explained how. Trump tried to do this in his first administration but was blocked by federal courts. The program was later ended by then President Biden. Dozens of white South Africans are en route to the U.S. after being given refugee status by the Trump administration. As Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg, the South African government is dismissing their claims.
The group of Afrikaners, the descendants of mainly Dutch colonists, left Johannesburg on a U.S. government charter flight on Sunday night. They were given refugee status after President Trump signed an executive order saying the minority group faced persecution at home. The South African government firmly denies that.
There are no legal or any factual basis for the executive order sanctioning this action. None of the provisions of international law on the definition of refugees are applicable in this case.
That was Vincent Magwenya, spokesman for the presidency. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
On Wall Street in pre-market trading, the Dow futures are up 1,000 points. It's NPR. The U.S. and China have mutually agreed to lower their steep tariffs on each other's products for 90 days. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has been meeting Chinese officials in Switzerland. The U.S. will lower its tariffs on Chinese goods from about 145% to 30%. China will lower its tariffs on U.S. goods from about 125% to 10%. For many, the perennial sound of spring or summer is on its way back. That is the sound of cicadas. A rare brood of cicadas that comes like clockwork every 17 years has begun to emerge in the eastern half of the U.S. NPR's Amy Held explains.
For the first time since 2008, Brood 14 is back. Some have been sighted in Tennessee, North Carolina, and Ohio. They're expected to emerge from Georgia to Massachusetts. Considered the second biggest of the dozen or so known periodical broods, they develop underground, then come out by the billions and buzz. That's on top of annual cicadas that emerge every year. Experts say far from being bugged by them, the insects give big benefits, improving water filtration, providing birds an important food source, and with their above-ground stay typically lasting just a few weeks, their decomposing bodies provide nutrition to the soil. But not until they've ensured the next generation to be heard from in 2042. Amy Held, NPR News.
This month's full moon is peaking tonight. Full moons have nicknames. This one is called the flower moon. The website Earth Sky says to look for the flower moon just after sunset in the southeast. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Good morning. President Trump leaves for the Middle East today, the first major foreign trip of his second term. It comes as his administration struggles to broker a ceasefire in the ongoing war in Gaza. Though Trump is expected to focus less on the quest for peace and more on making deals. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez has more.
President Trump is slated to land in Riyadh tomorrow. And there's a sense of deja vu. This was his first big destination in his first term, too. It was a big celebration. At one point, he was dancing, or at least swaying, back and forth, sword in hand, shoulder to shoulder with Saudi officials.
And it was an unbelievable day. It was in this gorgeous ballroom, and companies were there from many, many, probably 100 companies.
Trump is shoring up ties with the region after implementing a travel ban on some Muslim-majority countries and doing some business with autocratic leaders seeking global credibility.
It's a way of dealing with this administration. Gulf governments understand that this is a way of placating Trump and being in good graces with the administration.
Karen Young at the Middle East Institute says she expects more business deals this time around, but she says it's more complicated by so much unrest and uncertainty in the region.
A lot of the rhetoric is the same, but the world has changed.
In his second term, Trump is promising to bring peace to the Middle East and stop Iran's advances toward becoming a nuclear power. He also wants to persuade Saudi Arabia to normalize relations with Israel, joining what's known as the Abraham Accords.
The problem is that the war in Gaza has not ended.
Dennis Ross worked on Middle East peace for both the George H.W. Bush and Clinton administrations. Now, Saudi Arabia has long called for an independent Palestinian state. Ross says Saudi's crown prince is unlikely to be interested in the accords right now.
So long as the war in Gaza goes on, and so long as Israel's in Gaza, Mohammed bin Salman is very likely to say, that so sours the atmosphere that that's not something that he can be engaging in at this time.
That makes the business deals more important for Trump, Ross says.
Right now, the president doesn't have a lot of successes to point to. So, you know, I think he's going to want to play up the trip in terms of showing, look what I'm producing for the United States.
The Saudis have pledged to invest $600 billion in the U.S. over the next 4 years. Trump is also traveling to Qatar and then the United Arab Emirates, which has committed to spending $1.4 trillion over a decade. For Stephen Cook of the Council on Foreign Relations, the lasting memory of that first trip was how Trump basked in the glow of the extraordinary reception. And he expects more of the same on this trip.
The Saudis, the Emiratis, and the Qataris are going to fall all over themselves over who can outdo themselves to welcome the president.
Cook says the Gulf leaders have long understood what Trump wants and have an interest in giving it to him because there are other things they don't want Trump to ask about.
It's good for them because when he comes to them and says, we want your help doing something on Gaza, and they're not inclined to do it, they will be insulated from the criticism that would likely come if they just didn't do anything.
And he expects the leaders will also outdo themselves over the number of deals they can announce when Trump is there. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, The White House.
As we just heard, President Trump is focusing on security and diplomacy during his trip to the Middle East, and big business deals underpin both. He is looking to lock in massive investment deals with Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the UAE. Hussein Ibish is with us now to give us his take on this. He's an authority on Gulf state politics. He's a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. Mr. Ibish, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
So let me start with something that's gotten a lot of attention in Washington already. The Trump administration is in talks with the Qatari government about accepting a luxury Boeing 747 airplane that could temporarily serve as Air Force One. This, according to a senior White House official. What does this offer of the plane tell us about how Gulf leaders plan to handle their relationship with this president? And do they want something in return?
I think what they want is to lock in a strong relationship with Washington. And in the current administration, that is personalized. It means a strong relationship with Mr. Trump as a human being, as Big Daddy, as the tribal chieftain of the United States, not just kind of bilateral diplomatic relations, trade relations of the normal kind, but personalized relations with the president. Now, this comes easily to Gulf countries, which are led by monarchs and emirs and kings and what have you. For them, the kind of patrimonial, personalized rule of Donald Trump is familiar. And also, they have understood him. They've been dealing with him for many, many years, over 10 years as a president or would-be president. And they've come to understand him and what he wants, you know, the big dollar signs, both for himself and for the U.S.
So let's talk about these investment pledges. Trump says the Saudis, just the Saudis, for example, are pledging up to $1 trillion in U.S. investment. Is that real?
No. But it is serious that the Saudis do want to invest in the United States. They also want to give the president something to talk about. And they understood, especially by watching his behavior in his first major diplomatic trip in the last administration, the first Trump administration back in 2017, when he went to Saudi Arabia and made a big deal out of putting together a list of hypothetical contracts, real contracts, and also some deals that were struck by President Obama without giving him any credit, and came up with the largest possible figure and touted it around the United States. He's going to do that again.
But is there a quid pro quo here? That's one of the other questions I have. Is there a quid pro quo here, and what might that be?
Yeah, there is, which is a strong relationship with Washington, especially defense relations. They really rely on the United States for their security, and that hasn't changed.
So I think this relates to the first question I asked you, this kind of transactional diplomacy.
Yeah.
Is this business as usual, I guess, for the Gulf?
Well, sort of. No, not really, because if you looked at the Biden administration, for example, there's very little thought about what you could do personally for Joe Biden, or how you could give Joe Biden the biggest possible figure, whether it's fanciful or real. I think there was a lot of, for example, the Saudis were successful, and the Americans both, in crafting a strategic alignment and mutual defense agreement that was satisfactory to both. The problem is they couldn't get it through because it relied on Saudi normalization with Israel to be ratified in the Senate, and that wasn't going to happen if Israel wasn't going to be in any way responsive to giving something for the Palestinians. So it didn't happen. But in this case, it's really about what have you done for me lately, and what can you do for me personally?
I only have about 45 seconds left, so I do want to ask about this. Trump is skipping a stop in Israel despite the ongoing war in Gaza. Do you see a message being sent in that decision, being sent either to the Israeli leadership or to the Gulf states or both? Is there a message there in that?
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, you know, I wouldn't overstate it, but for sure, the relations between Trump and Israel are strained, both because the Gaza war continues and Israel is talking about completely reoccupying Gaza and hoarding all of its people into a tiny enclave in the south and really ramping up the death and devastation there. But also, really, because the Trump administration is going forward with nuclear talks with Iran, Israel is very opposed to that, but he's keen on a deal, and that has strained relations even more.
That is Hussein Ibish. He's a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. Mr. Ibish, thank you so much for sharing these insights with us.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
Students and alumni at Villanova, Pope Leo XIV's alma mater, held their first Sunday Mass since he was elected. Reporter Andrew Stelzer has more on how people who attended are celebrating the new Pope.
It was standing room only at Villanova Church's second Mass of the morning. Father Jeremy Hyers welcomed the crowd and its enthusiastic energy.
Wow!
Hyers said since Thursday's papal announcement, church attendance has been double the norm.
Now this is community! Wow!
Leo is not just the first pope from the United States. He's also the first Augustinian, a Catholic order founded in the 13th century. Villanova is one of few Augustinian universities in the U.S. It's where the Pope, then known as Robert Prevost, graduated in 1977.
With Pope Leo's help, we'll build a bigger church, because that's the Good Shepherd.
Catholics around the world are hoping Leo will attract more to the faith. Crowds of people are streaming out of morning Mass. There's also several groups of identically dressed women, soon-to-be graduates, taking pictures in front of the church. It's been quite a week of intertwining celebrations for them.
On top of graduation, it's like double the excitement.
Yeah. We made Pope hats. We had a party the other day. We made hats out of paper. I mean, every single person has texted me and was like, oh my gosh, the Pope is from Villanova. That's crazy.
Especially people at other Catholic
schools. Yeah, like my friend at Notre Dame was like,
Dr. Vanessa Gurley Holloway volunteers with one of the church's programs supporting homeless and low-income families.
I think it's a large sense of pride in the community. As Father mentioned during his homily, that, you know, many people, they've received applications now that want to be Augustinians.
Pope Leo has not announced any pending visits to his old school or to the United States. For NPR News, I'm Andrew Stelzer in Villanova, Pennsylvania.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Danny McBride talks about the final season of HBO's The Righteous Gemstones and his journey from Hollywood to South Carolina, where he co-founded Rough House Pictures. He'll tell us about how he's built a unique comic empire, blending sharp satire with Southern charm. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at EasyCater.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. For decades, American businessman Michael Calvi was bullish on doing business in Russia. He was the co-founder of a venture capital firm that had attracted billions of dollars for Russian companies. All seemed well until a falling out with a Russian business partner persuaded Russian prosecutors to charge him with fraud. Now free after a legal saga that went on for 5 years, including a two-month stint in a notorious prison, house arrest, and a conviction now nullified that Calvi still contests, he's written about all this in a new book called Odyssey Moscow. And Mr. Calvi is with us now. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle. I'm very happy to be here.
So, you know, Russia's relations with the West have waxed and waned, mostly, I don't know, waned over the 20 plus years you were in business with the country. And I just wondered, but all that time you were able to build your business. Could you just talk a little bit about that?
Well, I started working on projects investing in Russia when, you know, it was at the same time Yeltsin came and spoke to a joint session of Congress and had a standing ovation in 1992. So there was a tremendous amount of enthusiasm and support from the West towards the Yeltsin regime and towards the new Russia that they were building.
You talked about in the book about how there were certain red flags that were there, but you kind of ignored. Could you talk a little bit about that?
What I didn't really see and appreciate was behind the scenes in the banks, in the energy companies, of course, in every ministry, but also especially in every courthouse in Russia, the control and depth of control of the FSB over that, the eroding freedoms. It took my arrest to see it up close in the sort of cynical face of that system.
The FSB being the former KGB, what was the logic that you think now of your partners wanting to see you arrested? It seemed that you had useful contacts, transatlantic relationships. What do you think was the point?
Yeah, well, first of all, we made, 100 investments in Russia, and this was the only one where we ended up in a conflict with other shareholders of the same companies. The reason for the conflict, to be very short about it, is that we discovered that these two individuals who were shareholders of a small bank that merged with one of ours had stripped cash out of the company just before the merger. And, it became a dispute. We ended up suing them in London as the agreements stipulated. They realized they were going to lose and they could have lost everything. So they persuaded the FSB to launch a criminal case against me as the best way to save themselves.
You describe just the whole experience of going through the Russian court system is really disturbing. Can you tell me what about that experience really stands out to you?
Well, it was straight out of Kafka, and I did read Kafka's The Trial while our trial was going on, and it was, almost word for word in some cases. But it seemed to me that that the investigators realized within about a month that what they were accusing us of just was flat not true. It didn't happen. But they sort of think that all businessmen are guilty of some crimes. They just couldn't find it or prove it. But they also at that point realized that what they were doing was causing huge damage to the Russian economy and investment climate. So that's kind of where I think a compromise was made in the system, where they took me out of this notorious and miserable prison, but kept me under house arrest And it still took another couple of years to find a kind of face-saving way for the system to say, you know, they did something wrong, we couldn't prove it, but, you know, they've been punished enough, so we should sort of let them go.
I wonder if there's a lesson there for this administration, which seems to feel that an American presence, perhaps in Ukraine, or increasing the American business presence in Ukraine, would present an obstacle to further aggression. From your experience, is that a valid idea?
If that can be one of the carrots or incentives for Russia to come to the table and to make concessions that guarantee Ukraine's independence in the long-term future, then that's a worthy goal and it would make sense. About the investment in Ukraine, I personally don't expect there to be much value in those mining projects or effort, you know, or resources, rare earth minerals that are being talked about.
And why do you say that?
Those are mining projects. So before you could get anything out of those projects, you'd need to put billions of dollars into infrastructure and other types of operations. If there were super valuable and enormously profitable rare earth minerals in Ukraine, they would have been developed years ago by the many sharp-elbowed and wealthy Ukrainian businessmen who exist.
So the question then becomes, the argument is that an American presence, an increased American business presence in Ukraine, and presumably Russia, would be sort of protective.
One of the things that the war showed is that with countries like Russia and possibly also the United States, geopolitical matters will always outweigh business considerations. And when conflict, you know, in those matters arises, business people can be discarded like pawns on a chessboard. And I know what it feels like to be a pawn. I don't want to become one again.
Your case drew international attention. I was just curious about why you decided to write a book about your experience.
It was a life-changing experience, both for miserable and in some ways inspiring reasons. Inspiring, if you read the book, you'll understand why.
Well, let me just pause there because I was struck by, obviously, I think a lot of us have, you know, really, you know, horrifying images of what these prisons are like. But one of the things I found really striking was just the camaraderie with other prisoners and how they rallied to the occasion. Would that be a fair way to describe it?
Yeah, they, you know, how they supported each other. They supported me. It was especially a contrast with what I expected. I expected to be put in a cell with a bunch of hardened criminals who would be trying to intimidate me to admit guilt or something. And so it was inspiring. And I do dedicate the book to them. So, they were amazing guys. They had none of the advantages that I did. They didn't have the support of presidents of the United States and the whole Russian business community and a huge fund with an army of lawyers to support. And yet they were the ones giving me advice when I needed it.
Michael Calvi is the author of Odyssey Moscow, One Man's Journey from Russia Optimist to Prisoner of the State. Mr. Calvi, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
This is NPR News.
As President Trump exerts pressure to try to end the war in Ukraine, Poland is doing all it can to prevent another Russian invasion. The country is building up defenses along its border with Russia and has begun military training.
We have developed a strategy to counter any kind of mass land grab or mass land invasion or incursion that would occur.
I'm Elsa Chang, a look into Poland's preparations on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The Kremlin is rejecting an unconditional 30-day ceasefire in Ukraine. It's something Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky cited as a precondition before he would agree to attend direct talks in Turkey this week with Russian President Vladimir Putin about ending the war with Kyiv. President Trump says he will sign an executive order to reduce drug prices in the U.S. Here's NPR's Luke Garrett.
President Trump is promising to reduce drug prices by 30 to 80%, quote, almost immediately. Posting on social media, Trump says his executive order will lower pharmaceutical costs to, quote, the same price as the nation that pays the lowest price, end quote. He's calling it a most favored nation policy. In 2020, Trump signed an executive order of the same name and general principle, but it was blocked by the courts and then killed by President Biden a year later. The driving idea is that Medicare would refuse to pay more for certain drugs than the lowest price paid by other developed nations. Drug companies criticized the idea as unworkable and irresponsible in 2020. It's unclear what payments or drugs this new order would apply to. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump heads to the Middle East today. He plans to visit Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates on the first extended foreign trip of his second term in the White House. This is NPR News. Hamas is expected to release American-Israeli hostage Idan Alexander today. This follows secret talks between the U.S. and the militant group. NPR's Daniel Estrin says Alexander is one of two dozen hostages believed to still be alive 19 months after Hamas attacked southern Israel.
He's 21 years old. He grew up in New Jersey and moved to Israel to serve in the Israeli military. He was captured by Hamas in the October 7th attack while he was guarding his army base. And today, his mother is flying in from the United States with President Trump's envoy, Adam Bowler, to hopefully greet her son upon his release.
A Hamas official tells NPR on condition of anonymity that the Trump administration made promises in exchange for Alexander's release. Stocks on Wall Street opened sharply higher this morning after word that the U.S. and China have agreed to temporarily reduce the high tariffs placed on each other's products. It follows weekend talks in Geneva. Under the 90-day pause, tariffs on U.S. imports of Chinese goods will drop from 145% to 30%. China will lower its tariffs to 10%. Here's Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent.
We need more manufacturing. They need more consumption. So there is a chance to rebalance together. So we'll see if that's possible.
I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Capital One, with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldson. Good morning. President Trump is promising to put tariffs on imported pharmaceuticals. While big drug companies seem to have plans to weather the storm, independent pharmacists are trying their best to prepare with limited information. Jackie Fortier with our partner KFF Health News has the story.
Salt Lake City pharmacist Benjamin Jolly supports tariffs on pharmaceuticals in the name of national security.
If we go to war with China someday, like, there will be no prescription drugs in the United States unless something changes.
But on the other hand, tariffs could put independent pharmacists like him out of business.
I'm not sure that we're going to do it the right way, and I am definitely sure that it's going to raise the price that I pay my suppliers.
Independent pharmacists already face high operating costs and low insurance reimbursement for many generic medications. Some independent pharmacists were already struggling to keep the doors open even before President Trump launched his trade war.
The one word that I would say right now to describe tariffs is uncertainty.
Scott Pace is a pharmacist and owner in Little Rock, Arkansas. He's trying to predict what the pharmaceutical tariffs will look like.
We don't know what products, whether it's at the active product ingredient level or the finished product level, whether it's on the plastics that contain the products, whether it's on our vials or labels or lids.
Unlike other retailers, pharmacies can't pass along higher costs to their customers. The payments they get at the register are already set under contracts with health insurance companies and pharmacy benefit managers. So if tariffs happen, Pace is afraid pharmacists will have no choice but to eat the increased cost.
That's really a scary proposition on an industry that's already on razor-thin margins.
To try to weather major price fluctuations, Pace has stocked a three-month supply of his most commonly dispensed generics, cheaper versions of popular drugs.
Those are the ones that are the diabetes drugs, are the blood pressure medicines, are the antibiotics, are those things that I know folks will be sicker without.
Generics make up a whopping 90% of prescriptions in the U.S. John Murphy is president of the Association of Accessible Medicines, a trade group that represents generic manufacturers. He says if the tariffs happen, shortages will follow.
If you increase the cost of goods via tariff on a medicine that has, in some cases, less than a 5% margin, they just may not sell them in the United States.
Most pharmaceutical drugs go on a world tour before getting to your mouth. That pill you took this morning probably began as an active ingredient made in China or India. Those chemicals are then sent to other factories, usually elsewhere in Asia or in Europe, and made into medications. Murphy says no amount of tariffs will force generic drug makers to set up factories in the U.S. It's not only global competition that squeezes their margins. A patchwork of state and federal laws often restricts how much insurance plans in the U.S. can reimburse for generic drugs.
We don't pay enough for generic drugs in the United States for anyone to make the kind of investment that would be necessary to build new facilities in the U.S.
Neil Smoller, a pharmacist and owner in Woodstock, New York, says talk of tariffs makes him feel panicky.
How do I solve the problem of caring for my community, but not being subject to the emotional roller coaster that is dispensing hundreds of prescriptions a day and watching every single one of them be a loss or 12 cents profit?
Smoller says owning and operating a local pharmacy isn't the sustainable business it used to be. And if tariffs on any prescription drugs materialize, independent pharmacies already on the brink will fail.
That was reporter Jackie Fortier with our partner KFF Health News.
National politics are taking center stage in the race to be the next president of the District of Columbia Bar Association, and it shows in the unusually heated campaign rhetoric, as NPR's Carrie Johnson reports.
Elections to lead the legal association normally plod along without much outside interest. But this year, something's different. Bob Spagnoletti is CEO of the D.C. Bar.
I've been a member of the D.C. Bar for 30 years, and this is the first time that the election has generated this kind of interest.
He says nearly 30,000 people have already voted in the election. That's almost triple the previous record set in 1990. Some of that interest was on display recently at a reception to meet the candidates. Candidate Diane Seltzer is an employment attorney who operates her own small firm. Seltzer told the crowd about the fear she's hearing from lawyers across Washington.
We're no longer afraid of what if I'm not prepared or I missed a case that I should have known. We're literally afraid of terrible consequences just for doing our jobs.
In just 3 months, the Trump administration has punished big law firms because of their partners and clients, lobbed rhetorical attacks against judges, and fired career lawyers at federal agencies. Seltzer says she's listening to those people and making their concerns the center of her campaign.
My priority is making sure that the rule of law is upheld, that we feel that we are safe to do our jobs, and that we can go forward every day representing the clients we choose. Thank you.
The bar president mostly plays an administrative role and has no say in attorney discipline. Seltzer's running against prominent securities attorney Brad Bondi. Bondi's represented billionaire Elon Musk and the Trump Media and Technology Group. He also happens to be the younger brother of the U.S. Attorney General, Pam Bondi. On a Zoom forum last week, Bondi explained why he's in the race.
I'm running to lead our bar with the same care that I brought to serving my clients, to teaching at Georgetown and George Mason law schools, to raising my five children.
Bondi says the bar is at a crossroads and that it should steer clear of political debates.
I need your vote to keep our bar apolitical as it's meant to be, and I need you to spread the word to your colleagues.
So far, Seltzer's racked up endorsements from nearly two dozen former D.C. bar presidents. George Conway is a prominent critic of President Trump and his Justice Department. Conway drew national attention to the election a few weeks ago when he posted this on Instagram.
I'm asking you to vote, and most importantly, to vote against somebody, to vote against Brad Bondi.
Conway's not a member of the D.C. bar, and he's not eligible to vote there. But his video seems to have struck a nerve. The National Review magazine wrote a story headlined, "Don't Blame Brad Bondi for His Sister." Bondi used the issue to criticize his opponent at the candidate forum last week.
She posted on her social media claims that I was involved in a conspiracy to destroy the rule of law and was an existential threat to the country. My own children saw.
Seltzer replied none of those words had come out of her mouth. Then the moderator stepped in to end the debate.
Brad, your time is, I'm going to cut you off. I'm sorry. It is 7 o'clock.
Voting for the D.C. bar presidential election ends June 4th. Results will be announced a few days later. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
Research points to the chilling risks that AI companions can pose to kids and teens, including encouraging self-harm. How to protect your children next time here and now.
News stories do not wait to unfold. They just happen. And when they do, no matter where you are, NPR helps you stay connected. Listen live at this station's website or npr.org on your phone.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. For the sixth year in a row, two baby names are the most popular in the U.S. Drumroll, please. They are Liam and Olivia. And in second place were Emma and Noah. We know this because the Social Security Administration has been tracking the names of every boy and girl in each state for more than 140 years. Those four names, Liam, Noah, Olivia, and Emma, have either been first or second since 2014. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. There's some pretty standard advice from dietitians. Whole grains like brown rice and whole wheat are better than refined grains like white rice and pasta. Well, it turns out there's a way to make those refined grains healthier. Reporter Michaeline Duclef uncovered a superfood hidden in cold pasta salad and leftover rice.
Mindy Patterson is a nutritionist at Texas Women's University in Houston. She says that pasta and white rice are a bit, well, naughty.
Well, they're in a sense naughty because they are rapidly digested typically. So therefore, it creates a rise in blood sugar, and that happens pretty fast.
That quick rise in blood sugar isn't great for your health, especially if you have diabetes. Patterson says that over time, it can trigger inflammation, contribute to insulin resistance, and it just makes you feel tired.
If we don't have these spikes and dips in our blood sugar, then we tend to have more energy and just feeling better about ourselves, right? Healthier.
Whole grains, on the other hand, don't cause such high spikes in blood sugar because we digest their carbohydrates much more slowly. But in the past decade, scientists have figured out a way to make white rice and pasta less naughty to help us digest it more slowly. The trick?
If you put it in the refrigerator and cool it down, it contributes less sugar that can go to the blood.
That's right. If you take a hot plate of pasta or a steaming bowl of rice and chill it for 6 or 8 hours or even overnight, then when you eat the cold grains, your blood sugar won't spike as high. So in a way, cold pasta or leftover rice is healthier for you than their freshly cooked versions?
Yes, for sure.
And this trick also works for whole grains and beans too, making those superfoods even healthier. If you're wondering how this works, Maria Marco, a microbiologist at UC Davis, can help explain it. She says that as the pasta or rice sits in the refrigerator, some of its carbohydrates tangle up and stick together.
They're just twisted shapes or different branches. And what that means is that our enzymes can't reach it.
We can't break down the long chains of carbohydrates into simple sugars, so we can't digest them. Now, if you think about it carefully, scientists have a particular name for a carbohydrate that we can't digest: fiber.
This one kind of fiber.
And it's a special one. It's called resistant starch. Ravinder Nagpal is a gut microbiologist at Florida State University. He says that resistant starch is linked with a whole host of benefits. It reduces inflammation and helps you manage your blood sugar. It also helps improve your gut health because it feeds the trillions of microbes in your lower intestine.
Yes, our microbiome thrives on fiber and resistant starches.
Now, if you don't like the sound of eating cold rice or pasta, Nagpal says you can reheat it, but do it gently. Don't overdo it. Reheat it quickly in the microwave or
fry it lightly with some of your favorite veggies.
Otherwise, you'll lose this super fiber and its health benefits. For NPR News, I'm Michaeline Duclef.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at betterhelp.com/public.
This is NPR News.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. It was a relatively quiet weekend across the border between India and Pakistan. That's after the two nuclear powers agreed to a ceasefire on Saturday and after days of the most serious fighting between the two in decades. So what now? On the line with us to tell us more about this is NPR's Dia Hadid. She covers Pakistan and India from Mumbai. Good morning, Dia. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
How would you describe the mood today?
Well, I would say it's celebratory, especially in Pakistan, which is a far smaller country than India. And so the fighting there felt a lot more existential. And Pakistanis celebrated in the streets.
But people are also mourning their dead. 26 people were killed in an attack in late April in the Indian-controlled region of Kashmir. And India blamed Pakistan, and that triggered this escalation. More than 70 people were killed last week, and they include 13-year-old twins, Zain and Zoya, in Indian-held Kashmir. NPR spoke to the children's cousin, Sarfaraz Ahmed Mir, and he says his uncle was also seriously wounded and doesn't know that his children have been killed.
He says, my uncle asks my aunt, where are the children? And she says they're at home. And then she leaves his hospital room and cries. Mir says his aunt feels that if the fighting had continued, more parents like her would have lost their children.
Oh, that's just devastating, Dia. But what about the ceasefire? Is it holding?
Yeah. It's holding for now. There was tit-for-tat shelling of Indian and Pakistani border towns after the ceasefire was announced, but it died down. The ceasefire is holding. Both sides are claiming victory, saying they won, even though it appears that both sides had some big losses.
Would you say more about that? What do you mean by big losses? Like what?
India damaged multiple Pakistani air bases, including one near the capital, Islamabad. That's a fairly sizable breach. Pakistan claims it shot down 5 Indian aircraft, including at least one French-made fighter jet. India hasn't commented on that. And to give you a sense of how sensitive this is, it blocked one Indian website after it published a story about the aircraft being down. So I spoke to Siddharth Varadarajan. He's the founding editor of that site. It's called The Wire.
Not only is this a military loss, the larger question that have you then created effective deterrence against Pakistan, or have you, in a sense, made things worse? I think this action has opened up a whole can of worms.
A can of worms, he says. In the next few weeks and months, military and political analysts will be asking how robust India's defenses are.
That is NPR's Dia Hadid in Mumbai. Dia, thank you.
You're welcome, Michelle.
For the last 3 weeks, the U.S. and the Philippines have been doing military exercises together. They happen every year and are called Balikatan. This year, Japan and Australia also joined the drills, which come at a time of simmering tension with China. From the Philippines, Jan Kamzind Brumby has more. And a note, this story contains sounds of gunfire.
On the sandy shores of the northern Philippines, the small shrimping town of Apari has some new visitors. The glinting of its crystal blue waters are now replaced by the flash of muzzle fire. We're on the beach and the whole thing has been covered by US and Philippine soldiers. There are tanks, jeeps, tents set up, and hundreds of infantrymen practicing live fire drills.
This is a counter-landing live fire, so it's a simulated enemy naval advance.
This is Second Lieutenant Ben Gilman from the U.S. Marine Corps. He's participating in the drills.
What U.S. and armed forces of the Philippine assets are doing is repelling these forces and preventing them from landing on the beachhead.
It's part of the annual Balikatan exercises, Filipino for shoulder to shoulder. This time, they're trying something different, employing new Nemesis missile systems, nicknamed ship killers, and engaging in the first ever full battle test. The alliance goes back to a 1951 mutual defense treaty that commits Washington and Manila to respond in case of an attack in the Pacific region. In recent years, that region has grown increasingly contested.
To avoid miscalculations, leave the area immediately.
China and the Philippines have repeatedly clashed over territorial disputes in the South China Sea, or the West Philippine Sea, as Manila calls it. China has also stepped up its pressure on self-governing Taiwan. In the face of this rising pressure, U.S. Lieutenant General Michael Cederholm sees the exercises as a success.
The complex security environment calls for alliances to bond together with common purpose. All this is done for the defense of sovereign Philippine territory.
At a time when allies are questioning Washington's commitment to their security, in Manila, the Balikatan are viewed as a sign of continued U.S. support in the broader region, the size of that commitment evidenced by the size of the drills. Although Cederholm insists they aren't conducted with anybody in mind, some see things differently. Chester Cabalza is the president of International Development and Security Cooperation, a Manila-based think tank.
China has been involved in the evolution of the Philippine strategy and how we look at our foreign and defense policies.
But that strategy isn't always straightforward. China remains the Philippines' number one trading partner and retains strong economic ties to some Philippine regions, including Cabalza's own northern province of Cagayan. With Washington slapping 10% tariffs on Manila, the relationship with China is now even more complicated.
My province is polarized right now. If in case we go for China's support on our economy or we support the U.S., what we wanted is to build up our own military capability.
And speaking of building capabilities, those new Nemesis missile systems, well, they've been a success. The U.S. has confirmed they'll be sticking around for a while to be used in future drills. But not everything has gone so smoothly. We'd gathered in the Naval Command Center to watch U.S. and Philippine assets sink a decommissioned ship in the South China Sea. But the event, it was cancelled.
The decommissioned vessel took on water.
Just a few hours before its intended destruction, the ship had already taken on water and promptly sank of its own accord. Perhaps a fitting analogy for the Balikatan exercises. A decades-long ironclad defense commitment, trying to keep its head above water in an uncertain world. For NPR News, I'm Jan Kamsenbrumby in Manila.
This is NPR News.